From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. In case you missed the play when it had its debut, Rain Coming Down in Hollywood, or perhaps heard it on Call Chelsea Peretti, well, here's your chance to see the film version of that play in the movie First Time Female Director, which is on the Roku channel, having played it both Santa Barbara and Tribeca. It's writer, director, producer, and star. Chelsea Peretti's here. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
When I heard that play on the show, with all those pregnant pauses and everybody being a little bit too loud,
right,
in that way that they would be in a regional theater version of the Tennessee Williams. And by the way, Tennessee Williams' granddaughter was apparently there, so congratulations.
No way. Did I realize that? Oh, that was in the Q&A, right? Gosh, I almost forgot that. That is so crazy.
But you must have an affection for those regional theaters. Everybody's a little bit too loud.
I mean, it's just so many details, but I genuinely do love family dramas, you know? And then I love the theater sets that I really wanted that theater set of the house. I do love the ones that have two levels, but that was not within our budget. Apparently, it's extremely expensive to build a house that's structurally sound on a set. But I was really happy with our house with the laundry line. You know, there's so many tropes, both visually and performance-wise, of these rural family dramas that I love.
I have to say, the film in this weird way reminds me of a John Hughes movie. And that's sort of everybody's trying to step up, and there's a kind of like a mean contingent of people who are trying to manipulate the protagonist. And the protagonist is trying to show that they belong in a certain place.
I'm just happy it reminds you of any movie, you know? I set my sights pretty low. You know, it's like, not low, but, you know, it's like, with stand-up, I always said, like, it never even occurred to me to try to kill. You know, I was just trying to survive. And I feel with making this movie, it's like, I wanted to make it funny, but I think I almost forgot to be, like, really grand and pretentious. And I'm like, I'll do that my next one. Yeah.
But you tell a story here.
Yeah.
It's a story of a first-time female director. And,
that's right.
And it's also about that weird way in which theater kind of feels like it still lives in the 80s. And sort of the elbowing of the modern-day world into that kind of bubble that is the narcissism of theater.
Yeah, it doesn't feel very of the moment to what she's using. And so then when she does try to layer that in, it's so artificial, you know.
And desperate and, and need to be seen. I mean, that's the thing that I think that sort of has in common with, I think, the John Hughes movies, but also Christopher Guest, a bunch of people who need to be seen and heard and aren't quite listening to what's being said around them. And that's the kind of thing I think is really hard to do where somebody's doing that but not upstaging somebody else. And so, I'm sorry, it feels like a movie to me in that way, that you're able to modulate all this
Apology
stuff.
Accepted. It's crazy how we got into a huge fight right out of the gate.
Started it.
I know.
It is Santa Monica.
I'm people a like rabble rouser.
Or a rebel in your way. But I want you to talk about, because there's so many people in it.
Yes.
And we know who everybody is as soon as we meet them.
Good.
Which is kind of a tough thing to do.
Yeah, I had to even cut some characters. I mean, Amy Poehler, who produced it, was like, maybe cut some characters. I mean, it still was a huge ensemble, which is so funny to me because I just came off of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, which is also a huge ensemble. And you feel that, I felt that as a writer at Parks and Rec, where you're trying to write to every character. You're like, oh, we forgot this character, you know. And I felt as an actor where it's like this amazing gift to have a deep bench, but it also, it's like this panic when you're in the, when you're pulling the strings of like, am I short shifting anyone? You know, like wanting everyone to shine and wanting also to work with everyone I think is funny and trying to get as many of them in as I could, you know.
But it doesn't feel overcrowded because there's almost a new character in every scene, which is really fascinating. And I love that about it just because that could have been a really kind of hermetically sealed world. And in a lot of ways it is, but like the Uber driver or the stagehands who appear
the
again.
Techies. The techies. Yeah. I mean, the techies might be who I relate to the most in the whole film, you know. I'd like to do another version of it seen entirely from their point of view, you know. The surly, disconnected fringe person, you know.
your Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Mm-hmm. But again, they want to be heard too.
Yeah.
And that's actually something that you deal with a lot in your stand-up and the way people respond to wanting to be heard and also playing with audiences. Literally, in your special, you have these weird cutaways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My favorite is the cutaway to the sleeping audience.
Yes, yeah.
It reminds me of like the old school HBO where they were so badly directed, there'd just be these random cuts, somebody smoking who's looking away from the
stage. I know. They're almost disrespectfully chosen. You know, like you go, how does someone insert that reaction shot? It'll be, you know, a stand-up special. Someone does this big joke and then they cut to someone looking confused and turning to their partner like, what? You know, or whatever. It's like, was there nothing better you could have chosen to accent that joke? You know, it's always been funny to me. So it was fun to subvert that a little bit. And in particular, just the bravado of stand-up specials and just like, I'm the most important person in the world. And, you know, ending on the crowd sleeping was just satisfying for me.
Well, the crowd's not sleeping if you're watching first-time female director. It's on Roku, the Roku channel, which you know from your home video. My guest is it's star, writer, director, producer Chelsea Peretti. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But again, bringing in so many people, also Sam trying to be a different person with everybody she meets. Because we should say she's the writer, the playwright who gets promoted into being the director, which doubles her rate.
Right.
So it's not entirely altruistic.
Right.
But talk to me about creating that character, because there is, but she's not needy in the sort of subconsciously poignant way. So talk about making that character work in a way that keeps the comedy alive.
I'm curious how people are going to respond to it when it reaches a wider audience. You know, so far it's just been at Tribeca and Santa Barbara Film Festivals.
But what was the audience reaction in those theaters?
It was interesting. I mean, you know, I really love doing the Q&As afterwards, which is continuing the whole meta thing. but their questions are really thoughtful. And I really felt like I was hearing people laughing at strange jokes and thinking a lot. And that's kind of what I want, laughing and thinking. When I was like listening to it at Santa Barbara and I was like coming in at the end to do the Q&A and listening to it, I'm like, wow, this is really like densely worded dialogue and dense material. And it makes me want to write like next, like a very simple, like road trip movie with like silly people who say simple things, you know, but I was trying to be ambitious and reflective, but you know, just that you were saying that she changes based on everyone that she's talking to. And I think that if you're in a new position and you're seeking advice from people, you're going to get so much advice from people and it's all going to be conflicting and confusing. And I think what I've learned in this business is that you're constantly thrown into new positions that someone else might handle differently than you might handle it. And if you try to do it someone else's way, you're being inauthentic and not being organic to yourself. And that comes through, you know, and I feel like in the same way people are like dogs can smell fear. I feel like audiences, not always, because we've certainly been duped by a lot of people in Hollywood, but sometimes.
Whatever do you mean?
You know, sometimes like they sense that. They sense that and don't connect to it when you're not coming from a place that's real or connected in any way.
Well, it's fascinating because she is the most innocent person in that way. She wants to make everybody happy, which I think is really interesting. You know, I mean, whatever her therapist is saying to her, she's listening to, and we think, well, of course, this is a different relationship because this is her therapist. But then we realize she's kind of like that with everybody. To me, the line that made me laugh and broke my heart, she says, oh, I know how to read people.
Yeah. And then tussles his hair in a way that violates his body language, you know, like violates his personal space. It's funny because I don't think of her as innocent and I'm trying to think about why. And I think that it's that I think she lacks self-awareness and she has, you know, blinders on in a way. But yeah, I did want to be empathetic to her to a point. But I also wanted to be honest about her shortcomings and what might have held her back that was also her own shortcoming, you know, in terms, but also in the context of ways she may have also been set up to fail.
Because I wonder what she thought somebody else would bring to this play, because it's so inauthentic.
Yes.
because it's based on plays that are based on other plays.
Right.
It's like
derivative, yeah.
But not even, I mean, derivative is almost too strong a word for it. It's almost like she's heard people reacting to this play, and she, well, I can get that kind of response from people. Mm-hmm. Again, it's that thing of, and it's even something you so often make fun of, wanting to be seen and heard.
It's funny that you keep saying this, because I do feel like as the younger child in my family and just a family that was kind of chaotic, I think there is such a mantra in me of like, I want people to listen to me. So it's funny that you're seeing that in this character. And I do think that that is the subtext for a lot of performers, wanting to be listened to, you know, wanting to be seen. So, yeah, it's interesting that you keep saying that.
I mean, it's interesting to me because it's also this kind of line that runs through so many other characters in this piece. Mm-hmm. And again, each scene introduces somebody else who, hey, here I am.
Right.
And right down to those acting coaches. Mm-hmm. There were such specific parodies, yeah, of acting coaches and acting styles, and some being more invested than others, but also people constantly telling other people that you're wrong.
Right.
That happens a lot.
Instincts are wrong. You know, I feel like so much of that. I used to take a lot of theater classes when I was younger, but I haven't done the whole like LA acting class thing as much. And so much of what I heard from my friends when they would talk about it was just so much about telling them, no, your instincts are wrong, your this is wrong, your that is wrong. And like, it's interesting the process that actors go through.
I wanted to know, when you start to write that play, Rain Coming Down, which is the center of the show, what was it you think, each of those characters kind of gets an entrance in listening to that thinking back to that episode of the podcast. Mm-hmm. Each person, when they the first time they speak, is sort of like, the curtains are being thrown back.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I do think it's really funny, the idea of back-to-back monologues, like just characters all monologuing, and actors, it's like the epitome of being seen as a monologue, right? You know? So having it back-to-back, it's just like, oh, this is too much of a good thing. You know, the playwright is just giving them too much room to play almost, you know? And I think it's also like a question of, what should be seen, you know? And it's not just enough to just want to be seen. As Rudy Benito's character says, it's like, you also need talent.
Showing another lack of self-awareness. We're talking about a lack of self-awareness with my guest.
Yeah.
Chelsea Peretti. Her new piece, which is on Roku, is First Time Female Director. Maybe one of my favorite titles in a long time. We'll take a break this morning. Come stay with us. She's still here, Chelsea Peretti.
It's
The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. I've been a fan of her in so many ways for a long time. She's proving her mettle as actor, writer, director, producer for First Time Female Director, which is on Roku. You can hear this show, not on Roku, kcrw.com/The Treatment. Talk to me about finding the people, because so many of these clearly are people that you've worked with and known for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, I think I often look at my friends who are so talented and think about ways in which the industry could use them better than they do, you know? And not to say I've necessarily pulled that off, but I always wish that everyone I knew had better managers, better agents, better scripts, you know, whatever. And I loved having like Jermaine Fowler rolling around in a pile of cords, you know, which was his suggestion. You know, I said, can you be this, you know, cameo in this really esoteric play, avant-garde play? And he's like, yeah, could I roll around in a pile of cords? And I'm like, absolutely, you know. But getting a chance to just go, okay, I've known Jermaine for years and I'd love him to do something. I think he's so silly. And then him doing this thing, I mean, that was actually our first day of shooting and I actually cried laughing. I think that was the only time I cried laughing. There's so much more footage of him in these cords. It really wound up being like so deep in a way, is like of a visual poem of just what it feels like to be just swimming in technology, particularly in a generation that knows what life was like before that, you know?
What fascinates me about it, Chelsea, is just that given it's a piece about narcissists, mm-hmm, all the obvious generosity that these performers have. I mean, because nobody steps on anybody else. Mm. I mean, and there are so many moments where, you know, if these real life people actually in this, they would be pushing each other out of the way all the time. But I was fascinated by the degree to which you're able to sort of keep people, not keep people in balance, or cast people who knew when to work. Given that it's a, again, a piece about a bunch of really thirsty people, I think I was really impressed by that.
Well, I think everyone just has great instincts. And I also just think some of it is that, this is going to sound sort of weird, but staging wise, I really did want the staging to be looks real and not look like a bunch of people in a line, you know, with an ensemble. That's like a pet peeve visually. I hate when you see people standing in a line having a conversation. And I do feel I was happy with how the staging of this large cast worked out. And I was thinking a lot about a couple movies, Birdman, which, you know, mine is a documentary style, so it's very different from Birdman, but I loved how dramatic and self-serious and in the theater world that movie is. Waiting for Guffman, which is a clear touchstone for it, but I was trying to, you know, add a different perspective and different, I guess, social issues that were on my mind. And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
John Hughes.
Okay, so there you go. You were right. Yeah, so I think Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I just loved the simplicity of the story, you know? And I've been in lots of writer rooms, and many times that's very much frowned upon, simple plots.
Why?
You know? Because I think, like, people don't think simple plots are smart plots or good plots, but I really loved that they're just trying to get home for the holidays, you know? And then you just get to see John Candy and Steve Martin shine so much, their characters and how they play off each other, and bad things keep happening. And that's kind of my movie, is bad things keep happening to this woman who's just trying to be heard and trying to be respected and trying to thrive, and kind of, you know, ultimately falls short.
Because it's funny, as I was listening to that play, I just thought, what advice has she listened to up to that point that made her finish that play? I mean, because to me, there's so much there that I end up asking these kinds of questions that are kind of backstory, which for me doesn't happen very often in comedy.
Yeah.
Because so much comedy is about presentation, this is the moment, and what's next, and the joke. But for this, I've really found myself immersed in trying to figure out who these people were before we met them, which I think is a sign of real invention.
Yeah, I think we cut some scenes that maybe would have shown a little bit more that Sam has written a series of plays there. You know, it was like rain's coming in, but then it was like heat storms of passing through. They were all like, and there was a scene where Kate and Benito were walking down a stairwell referencing all these posters of her past plays. So the idea was that she was kind of a journeyman that had been at this local theater and, you know, kind of just writing play after play, and never would have occurred to her to have a bigger ambition. And then she's thrust into this position and says, oh, maybe I should do this. And I don't know if I should do this. Maybe I should do this. And then just very quickly is like, of course I should do this, you know?
We're talking about raindrops the size of gumballs with my guest.
Yeah.
Chelsea Peretti. A line that's lived in two different venues. It's a treat, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. Her film, her terrific film, is First Time Female Director. It's on Roku. I guess I was asking about the audience just because it's one of these things where I think people will be laughing two scenes later at a joke they just got. Because it's got that kind of density you're talking about that you think about with the Chris Guest movies. Because they're also about behavior, which I think is hard to do. But you've come through a lot of stuff in television that's also about behavior that wasn't sort of necessarily so narrative driven, but about people behaving in the moment with each other. And that's clearly had an influence on what you've done with this film.
You know, I've had the honor of being in a variety of writers' rooms. And I do think, like, everywhere I've gone, I've sort of tried to pick up something or another, you know, and bring that little bag of tricks towards this project. I'm excited to pay it forward to the next one, because there's definitely so much you learn when you are in a new position of leadership. And
for example,
well, you know, I know, like, I always say this, but like my first day at Brooklyn Nine-Nine, like as an actor, I was standing in front of the other actor's camera because I wasn't thinking about coverage in that way. You know, that simple of a thing I just wasn't aware of. And so that was a learning curve, you know. You know, with directing, I think, like, for me, particularly being in the film and directing it, I think I should have thought a lot harder about how I was going to approach that. I think I was thinking so much about the script, the casting, the this, the that. Like, you know, there were so many details to figure out that I think, you know, after I finished shooting this movie, I created a whole document of what have I learned just for myself to have so that it's all committed somewhere to paper so that when I start my next project, I'll have that there for me so that I don't forget any of those lessons. You know?
What were some of those lessons?
Only joke answers come to mind. But, you know, one thing was like, I think because, like I said, I feel like I had a bit of a chaotic childhood at times. I think I was really willing to problem solve creatively with things that came up. And I think in some cases, I shouldn't have problem solved so much. You know, I should have possibly said, let's not shoot this scene if we can't shoot it this way. You know, in general, I think it was a great skill to be flexible, and you have to be, because problems arise and you have to be malleable. But I do think one thing I did think was, you know, there was a couple instances where I should have said, listen, we should either cut this scene or shoot it on push it to a different day, because these parameters are not going to serve the scene. Mike Schur at Parks and Rec, when he ran that room, he was very much like, if we would get network notes, he'd be like, you know what? Notes are good. Like, it may not even be the exact note that we're going to implement in the exact way it's laid out, but it might be that there's something there we need to look at. And I just loved that he had such a laid back attitude about getting feedback, you know, and some artists are like, the suits, this, that, you know, and I think feedback and notes are helpful, and being able to adjust things. You know, I didn't want to be a director who's like, every word is precious, every moment is exactly as it should be, you know, but I do think in some instances, it is good to be that way.
It seems like you're caught between whether you're going to service the actors, because you know that that's who you are. Mm-hmm. That's almost your first thought is, so how do I make this easier for them? And and then you have to also step back and think, well, this is a bigger project. And if it's not working for me in this moment, it's not going to work for them when this thing is done.
I mean, honestly, I was actually thinking more about production issues. Like, there was a scene in the park, in Griffith Park, where I was supposed to jump out of a tree. And when we got there,
instead of jumping off the tree trunk?
Yeah. And okay. So I was supposed to be off a high branch and jump down, which is really funny to me. It is challenging, but there was going to be a stunt person. It was going to be fine. But we get to the location, which was Griffith Park, and they're like, okay, a couple ground rules, no climbing in the trees, no this. And I'm like, what? You know, and so then it became a stump, which is just not as much of a visual joke, you know, it's not as extreme. Anyhow, there was a lot of stuff like that kind of thing times 1,000, where you just are like, you know. And that's, I think, par for the course.
But you sing that moment out, and I thought, that's so funny to me, because that to me seems so Sam. She's on that stump, leaning forward like she always does.
Yeah.
She's, in effect, trying to turn that stump into like an intimate space. So that feels
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, no, there's something more pathetic about the stump, for sure.
Entirely.
Like, you know, it's a tree that is no longer alive. That's just forever you know, static in space until it slowly degrades, you know?
But also, it was weird way, it kind of speaks to her kind of lack of imagination in a subtextual way that I thought was really interesting. So that's a great problem solve,
Well, I loved Holy Grail. That was one of my favorite comedies. And I remember reading that their budget was minuscule and it like rained every day. And, you know, so I do really try to believe that necessity is the mother of invention and that things happen how they're meant to. But yeah, it wasn't even necessarily that moment that I'm thinking of, but there's just a couple things where I was like, oh, I might have tried to maintain how it was written before quickly, you know, changing it to fit our schedule or to fit whatever the need is in a couple instances. But yeah, the actors, I mean, I did incorporate their instincts in a way that I really enjoyed. You know, I think often in comedy, especially as comedy has gone from when I was a teenager watching like Martin and Living Color, you know, with Jim Carrey and Austin Powers and, you know, Adam Sandler movies, they're big, huge swings, broad comedies. And then it kind of I don't know what word to say. I was going to say morphed, evolved. I don't want to say evolved because I love those comedies. So morphed into this more naturalistic or twee kind of like Wes Anderson or Judd Apatow movies, which I also loved. As it kind of moved towards this more naturalistic style of comedy, I felt as an actor that it was sort of frowned upon to take these big swings. And for me, what I wanted to do tonally, and you can be the judge if I achieve that or not, but was sort of integrate those and have this broad silliness that also could fit in with moments that were smaller, more naturalistic, and had some social relevance versus just being, you know, silly.
Because I think those comedies you're talking about, there's finally something kind of predictable about them. Mm. And you like those moments that catch you off guard.
Right.
And so, and I think actually Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is one of those kinds of movies too. Mm. That's about behavior, but also about these things that come out of nowhere. And it's also about us getting to know character. And all those things I think you sort of bring to bear here in First Time Female Director.
I mean, listen, I just hope people like it. And I hope people get some inside jokes off of it like we have in making this movie for the time that we've spent with it. And I'm looking forward to sharing that with people, and I'm excited to see what next movie I have in me as well.
Have you written your next script to direct?
I haven't written the script. I have a couple ideas I've been sort of working on. And, you know, I also want to write a TV show. So I've been sort of in a very creative, expansive place, I'll say.
Do you miss that? The camaraderie of the writer's room?
I do.
Acting, all those things that you get. And it's a really intense thing that everybody I know who does this says, it seems like it takes forever, and then you realize the season is over and and you miss it.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that. It's just like almost like having a kid. You're like, you know, I forget the expression, but they say it's like, you know, it's so long and then it's so short at the same time.
The days are long and the years are short.
Exactly. And I feel like that applies to writers' rooms. It's like you are making a baby in there. And it is like this painstaking thing. I should clarify, you're not literally making a baby in there.
Well, this would explain a lot of writers' rooms.
But, you know, it's like it is this delivery. You are like working together to deliver something into the world. And it can be really painstaking, and it can be so funny. And I mean, you know, at Parks, we just went on such insane tangents that were so intellectually and comedically stimulating. And sometimes those little germs would turn into something in a script, and it would just be really satisfying. So yeah, I miss having heated debates about very stupid things.
And on that note, we will be done with
all right,
Chelsea Parade. But just for now, when she comes back with her new TV show or film, whatever,
yes,
it'd be a thrill to have you back. My guest
Thank
is Chelsea
you.
Parade, her film debut as director, then star, and producer, and writer, is First Time Female Director on Roku. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. This was fun.
The comedy film that takes us backstage. It's called First Time Female Director. Itself comes from a first-time female director, Chelsea Peretti, who also stars in the film and wrote it. It's currently on Roku. Peeks at life from backstage and other viewpoints at the archive, kcrw.com/thetreatment. Join us here at Center Stage, where there's more to come. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. In the screenplay, One Day When I Was Lost, James Baldwin writes of one of the lines from Malcolm X, the protagonist of the film, is, "I have had so many names, and so has my guest. He has been known as Billy Diamond, or Gail Sayers, or Lennox, or Harvey Dent, or Scott Joplin, or Louis McKay, or perhaps best known as Lando Calrissian. I tend to think of him as Billy D. Williams. He has finally settled down to write a book. The book is What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life. My guest is the one, the only, the estimable Billy D. Williams. Billy, thank you so much for doing this. And first of all, I started off by quoting from One Day When I Was Lost, and your friendship with James Baldwin. And I got to meet him once myself when I was in college. And what was so incredible about him is, for such a small person, how much presence he had, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, he was huge. He used to call himself an ugly little black but it had a real bite to it whenever he said it. It was like, I know something that you don't know. With that Jimmy Baldwin smile. He was more man than most men that I ever met.
Wow, because I wonder what it was like for you when he first mentioned to you that he wanted you to play Malcolm.
Well, that was a great idea. I think I would have done that. Obviously. You know, the first time I saw Malcolm X was on television. I was singing at the Playboy Club. In 1961, I think it was 61. It was the first time I had ever heard a black man talk the way he talked. And it was quite impressive for a young man. I was only about 24 years old, something like that. So when that moment came, when Jimmy and I met each other, and he saw me in Hallelujah Baby with Leslie Uggams, on Broadway, he approached me and asked me if I wanted to play Malcolm X. I said, of course, yes. He was writing it for Columbia Pictures at the time. But Columbia Pictures was more interested in James Earl playing it. But Jimmy had a whole different vision of Malcolm's life from when he was very young and until his demise. But we never got around to doing it. But anyway, I think I would have done a very interesting portrayal.
I'm sure you would have, because here's the thing that I get from the book and having watched you do so many things is you're such a physical actor to me. So often I think about you in the way you walk into a scene or your entrances. And a lot of that comes from your preparation as a stage actor, doesn't it?
Well, I think, you know, doing stage work is, well, I don't know if it's essential, but I think it's important. And then because you can learn an awful lot about yourself, how to make an entrance, how to use your body, how to use your voice, how to use your presence in total. You know, I remember, you know, meeting when I first met Olivier, when I was doing A Taste of Honey on Broadway with Joan Plowright, with his wife, who Joni later became his wife after he divorced Vivian Leigh. Anyway, I used to spend time talking to him. And one of the things I always liked about Olivier was that he was like a sponge, first of all. He was always, rather than imposing himself on an individual, he was more like a sponge. He was always asking questions. I thought, this is why this guy is really good, because he's not trying to impose himself. But one thing I remember reading about him as an actor, unlike the Edmund Kean School of Acting, like Gielgud was from that school, acting from the neck up, you know, it's all words. Olivier was more physical. And he even got, I think at some period in his career, he was criticized for being so physical and doing interesting things with his voice. And I was always impressed with that. I mean, I love the whole idea of being a maverick. I mean, it's always been very much a part of my life. And I think it was also very much a part of when I came along that particular period. I mean, you had Jimmy Dean, you had Brando, people like that. Sidney, when he came along, he presented a whole perspective of acting that I had never experience with other black actors. I mean, it was all part of the Stanislavski school of acting. You know, I see myself as a full spectrum of colors. I mean, and as a painter, you learn a lot about that. In terms of my acting, in terms of my painting, I'm always trying to approach my craft or crafts in that manner.
You mentioned Olivier, and you also mentioned in the book that you're the one who asked him about Othello.
Yeah. That was great. He said, yeah, he had thought about doing Othello, his playfulness. He deepened his voice, so he obviously went to a voice coach. And of course, he darkened his skin. But he did one other thing that I thought was really hysterical. He stuck his ass out and walked around with his, with a kind of a gait, with his ass sort of protruding. Because I think in his mind, black people have big asses. I never forgot that. I just fell out laughing when I saw it. But it was, I thought, outrageous, courageous, and outrageous. It was wonderful.
My guest, whose book could have been called The Man Who Told Olivier to Do Othello, is Billy D. Williams. His book is called What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But there's so many great stories in this book. I mean, you just mentioned Olivier, but you're one of the few people who had a chance to see Alvin Ailey as an actor, right?
Yeah, that's when he was on stage. What was it? I think it was called Place Without Twilight. And I was standing by, hoping to do the role. And Claudia McNeil played the mother. And I remember one night, she slapped him in the face. And his mouth was moving, but nothing was coming out of his mouth. I was in hysterics, standing out in the audience.
You have this incredible period in the early 70s where you go from Gale Sayers to The Glass House to Lady Sings the Blues. And they're all, for me, really physical performances in very different ways. I mean, I mentioned this to you before in person, but what I love about your Lennox in The Glass House is he's somebody who makes every moment count. He knows he's not going anywhere in prison. We should say this is an adaptation of a Truman Capote story that was done for TV by Tom Grease. And you're so good in it. And these three performances are so different and show how much range you had. But again, they're all, for me, very different physical performances.
Yeah, you know, that's why I always thought, I said, how come these people in Hollywood won't give me an award? What's the matter with these people? You know, listen, my feeling more than anything else is that rather than being number one, being first is much better. It becomes then a matter of history. So at least I had that much.
Yeah, but you got to give the performances. And I think as you get to in the book, the time was right for you. You were hungry. You were ambitious. There are a bunch of things you wanted to do. But I think these three moments for me, and you're right. And I think had it been now, the world would be going crazy for you. But they didn't know what to make of you as somebody who looked the way you did, who could play three people who were so totally different. And each of me, there was this kind of shyness.
And I was cute.
You were cute. I think I go a little farther than cute, if you don't mind me saying so. You were dark Gable and still are, but to be able to do all those things and to look the way you did. And like I was saying, your Gale Sayers is somebody who takes his time, is kind of a country boy who doesn't quite know how to articulate himself. And Lennox is somebody who knows how to make every word count. And I almost feel there's a little bit of a Jimmy Baldwin in him because the way he uses words in Glass House are like knives. And then your Lewis McKay is, as you mentioned, you modeled a little bit on Tyrone Power in Black Swan. So those, to me, are such great performances coming in that really compact period of time. That must have felt like a great period for you.
No, it was great. I mean, I was experimenting in exactly the way I wanted to experiment. So for me, personally, it was gratifying. You know, I grew up in those years where individualism was prevalent in people's lives. That is something that always interested me. And I even took classes in futurism. So that's where my head was at when I was coming along in those years. So I was always looking to break the rules. And I didn't want to be part of a stereotype or stereotype ways of doing things.
So much about your life, as you mentioned in the book, is about people seeing these things in you. And you, all these people you encounter who really know something about you that, that they inform you about. Like you mentioned your time with Jerome Robbins, and although it didn't end up being a long-term relationship, he told you something about yourself too that helped you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I joined his company. He got very much interested in doing Japanese no theater. He was putting together a production based on the assassination of JFK. But he gathered a group of wonderful actors, but he wanted to use them in ways which was very interesting, using a lot of movement, dance movements. But he realized that I was not really an ensemble player, that I was more interested in building a career for myself as an individual. We had a discussion about it, and I left. But he understood, which I thought was very perceptive of him, actually, that he knew that my interest didn't lie in the whole ensemble approach to theater.
There are so many moments in your life, as you depict in the book, a reevaluation. And one of the great parts to me is you talk about what it was like doing the show Fences on Broadway and how that actually brought you back to your first love, which is painting.
Yeah, it was one of those fortuitous moments, I think. I always say that every time I wanted to go right, something said to me, no, Billy, go left. So there was one of those kind of moments where I was meant to go back to New York, to go back to the stage and do that play, August Wilson's play, Fences. One part of me really looked forward to it, but I was still in search for something. And at that time, I was hanging out with Peter Max, which was really gratifying because it really got me back into thinking about this ability that has sort of laid kind of dormant for a while. So anyway, when I spent, after 6 months on Broadway, on stage, I came back home and I had my easel set up in my studio. I had my paints, I had my brushes, I had everything ready for this grand moment. And when I got back home, I just started painting. It was like I was regurgitating, just one painting after another for years. Until now, I have about 300 paintings stored away.
What's fascinating to me about that section of the book and that part of your life is that, and I saw you do, I saw the show. I hadn't met you yet, but I went to see you do Troy and Fences. And it's a really demanding part. It takes a lot out of you. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the book, you really, I think of you, especially gotten to know you a little bit, first and foremost as a painter. And you actually work as an actor, as the way a painter does. And so it took something that was really that, again, that challenging a part to remind you who and what you were.
Yeah. Following James Earl, because James Earl had been working on that character for a long, long time. I think he was doing it at Yale. That's where he started developing the character. So following up on James Earl was a monumental kind of undertaking. I never really felt comfortable with that character, to tell you the truth. I almost couldn't wait, although I don't say this, but I almost could not wait until I was through with the character.
Wow, but no, that makes sense to me, because I could see, I mean, the way you moved on stage as that guy wasn't the way I'd ever seen you move on stage before. It's almost like he had this weight on him. Your shoulders were hunched a little bit. You swiveled your head like you're looking for a fight. And it's interesting to hear that you couldn't wait to be done with it.
Well, you know, at the end of the play, I did something that August hated and Lloyd Richards hated. I took the baseball bat and used it as a kind of a phallic symbol towards the, you know, saying, "F you, f off." You know, that was how I ended it. And I wasn't supposed to do that. But again, I wanted to do something that is totally outrageous.
As a kid who grew up reading comics, when I saw Tim Burton's Batman and I saw you as Harvey Dent, I thought, oh my God, it's going to be perfect. Billy Dee Williams getting to play Two-Face in a future Batman movie. And you mentioned that in the book, that you had the same thoughts.
When they hired me, John Peters wanted me to be in the movie. He wanted me to play Harvey Dent. But I was looking really to end up playing, obviously, Two-Face. But it never happened. I mean, you win some, you lose some. But that was really what I wanted to do. I would have done an interesting a characterization if I had done it. I mean, I like Tommy Lee Jones. I find him a very interesting performer. But I think I would have done something really interesting with Two-Face. It's too bad I didn't get a chance to do it. However, later on, people would do these animations of me playing Two-Face, which I find pretty ironic.
Well, my guest who does nothing, had done nothing in his life and career but take big swings and big chances and tell Laurence Olivier he should play Othello is Billy Dee Williams. His book is What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Billy. Thank you so much, and thanks so much for being part of my documentary. It is almost everybody's favorite part of the film.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. I'll see you soon.
The one and only Billy Dee Williams, star of stage, screen, and TV, and now books. His autobiography is called What Have We Here, and it's out now. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. This is The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The film adaptation of The Zone of Interest has garnered Oscar nominations for Best Director, Adapted Screenplay, and Picture. It's writer-director Jonathan Glazer on a stunning achievement of insight and empathy.
Hello, my name is Jonathan Glazer, and this is The Treat. There's a film made in 1963 called The House is Black. And The House is Black is a short film made by an Iranian poet, and I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, Farrukh Farrukhzad. And it's only 20-odd minutes long, and it was basically set in a leper colony. It's like an essay, really. It's her poetry. There's also lines from the Old Testament in it. There's lines from the Quran in it. And she was a remarkable radical poet in Iran in the 1960s. And this is, I think, the only film she ever made. So she made this film where inside a leper colony in Iran, and I think it was a hospice, in fact, and she is filming the people in the leper colony with such dignity, such humanity. It's one of the most searing things I've ever seen, actually. Nothing is emphasized. There's no sort of emotional emphasis on anything. It's a presentation of human beings who are disfigured from their illness and live together in a community, effectively, away from the rest of the world. The beautiful thing about a camera like that is that it is, there's no judgment in it whatsoever. It's like Nabokov's eye. It's a witness. You're bearing witness to something. And she actually adopted a child, her son. She adopted from her experience of making the film in the leper colony. She ended up adopting a child from that leper colony as her own son. So I think everything about her and everything about that piece of work is sort of the best of us somehow. There's something about this film that is so coruscating, so humanist, so political, that really I can't urge you enough to see it.
Oscar-nominated director and writer Jonathan Glazer, whose new film is a zone of interest, on the landmark short documentary, The House is Black. Emmy-winning director, writer, and actor Bill Haderstreet is a potent and uncompromising documentary that, like many others, can be found at kcrw.com/thetreat. Experiences that seep into the minds and souls of creators and fields from film to books, music to style, experiences that undeniably help to form the sensibilities that they pass on to us. It's The Treat. The show is produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. We get by with help, and not just a little bit, this week from Laura Kondarajan, Sue Margulies, and Phil Richards. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.